Welcome to the All About Alts podcast, where we explore the world of alternative investing to help you find financial independence. Join our host, Newview Trust's president, Jason DeBono, as he covers a variety of topics with different guest speakers to discuss tax and alternative investing strategies. It is never too late to start taking control of your financial future, and we are so excited for you to be joining us for this opportunity to hear from some of the best in the business.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the All About Alts podcast. I am your host, Jason DeBono. I am here with Stephen Gessis of Smart Land Real Estate. Stephen, how are you?
I'm doing excellent. Thanks, Jason. Great to be here with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, excited to have you. So Stephen is one of the founders at Smart Land, currently serves as COO, EVP. So been there since the doors opened 12 years ago. I assume a pretty good bird's eye view of what's been going on there the last 12 years.
That is for sure. Bird's eye view is definitely the proper term, probably. That's right.
Yeah, and I would imagine, over those last 12 years, everything's just looked the exact same, right? It's pretty much you're doing today what you did then. There's been no market conditions, no black swan events like COVID, no run-ups in real estate, no interest rate hikes, nothing, right? That's impacted what you guys do daily.
Well, you know, we started in a rough patch of time during that great financial crisis. So we are we're built for agility, and so our onion has not only grown, but it's probably changed colors.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. I mean, you know, going back 12 years, I think if I'm doing the math right without my shoes off, that's 2012. Really right in the depths, that 2010 to 2012-13 was a real kind of, I would say, the shallowest point of the Great Recession. Everybody was just kind of looking around. There's a lot of uncertainty. And here you guys are, starting a real estate business, and you didn't just start a business, you kind of exited another real estate business and kind of restarted. So give us a little bit about that background. What were you doing prior to 2012? And then, how did Smart Land come into existence?
So, I joined the other two founders, Irina Klainer and Vadim Klainer, here at Smart Land in 2012. But prior to that, I had joined him at what was Cleveland Property Management. At that time, it was 2010. I had just been—I just finished some graduate school, working 8-to-5 job. Me and Vadim had known each other from before, and I had known that he got into the property management business, buying, owning, working, managing, whatever had constituted that at the time. And I had reached out and I said, "Hey, you know, there's an opportunity to possibly expand the construction side of the business. You mind if I tag along?" type of thing. And so they allowed me the opportunity to tag along, and I was there with them when we exited Cleveland Property Management, which is about 1,000 single-family scattered site, single-family residential portfolio of property management. And at that time, it was about 2013-14, and we had put together the future, which was Smart Land. And the intent was to have a unified and standardized approach to the whole entire process, because not only is scattered site complex in its own right, but you know, when you're acquiring or managing on behalf of other people, you can get a mix of product lines within that portfolio. And so it makes it really tough. I always call it, you know, being tough, being pickle in the middle, being right there in the center of everybody's problem. But we were able to really harness that and identify what were the key distinct tough things to do. And then, Jason, you know, interesting that you brought that up, because if we go history lesson and black swan events and all of that stuff, you know, then we were almost like pioneers, right? Doing the single family scattered site thing. It was not a hot topic. Like it was still like, I wouldn't call it like mainstream, right? It was like the underground for mom and pop investors, right? And so our goal, the intent was like, we just want to give people a good opportunity. We didn't have a positive experience ourselves when we needed property management. And so we opened up a property management company to give people that positive experience that they would want or expect from a property management company, as we would. as an investor, right? Like all the things that an investor wants, like we want that also. It's just kind of simple on our side of the equation. So that was off the heels of that, you know, great financial crisis. We were able to buy really well, and then obviously sell the business at that time. And what was fascinating is that it was turning the scattered site product that's so super complex and putting a real system behind it, right? Like trying to systematize it. So after selling the business, the idea, and again, the intent was we're going to start all over again. We're going to start buying the single family homes, and we're going to open up basically like a retail store for investors to come in and buy ready to go turnkey assets. So we were different from everybody else in the marketplace where, you know, you had investors, they would maybe find a manager and they would say, hey, can you help me buy a home and help me renovate the home? And then, you know, can we lease the home? So we did all those steps in advance. So by the time the investor walked into the Smartland store, he was able just to take a property right off the shelf, like you would of any retail store that had already, you know, been purchased, renovated, acquired, resident placed in it, qualified resident placed in it. And it was operated as a business rather than, you know, there's a lot of personal ties to single family residential. And so we really had to identify at that time, and again, and clients are vary, but primarily most of our clients have tend to be, you know, individuals that are looking to grow their wealth. They're looking to grow by diversifying their portfolio using alternatives, hence, you know, whether it's using their IRA. We have a lot of clients that use NewView as the custodian, which is a pleasure to work with. And they're just looking to expand and expand their horizons. And so that evolved eventually into what Smartland is today. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But that scattered site and going through that systemization of getting everything uniform, standardized, was really pivotal for our overall growth and success for our clients. I think that that's what's important to know.
Well, you know, you mentioned turnkey, and you know, it's yeah, probably we're kind of out way out in front of that. I mean, today the idea of turnkey rentals is like a, you know, second nature. We hear it all the time, but you know, going back to 2012 and 13, that was a pretty new concept. If you could even get your hands on it. So I think, you know, groups like yours were pioneers, I think, in helping the masses enter into the real estate market more so than probably would have originally. You know, a lot of casual passive investors, you know, they don't want to own real estate. I shouldn't say they don't want to. They want to own real estate. They don't want all that comes with owning real estate. And so, you know, we've seen a lot of our clients that just love the turnkey model and they love passive investing because they get access to these alternative type assets. They understand real estate. You don't have to, you know, be an investment guru to turn on the news or just to look in the neighborhood you live in and see that things are going up and there's a lot of money to be had and there's tax benefits. And so I think it's opened the door for a lot of investors. And, you know, your evolution at Smartland, you know, you guys have now, you've gone out of the scattered site, you know, you've gotten through the turnkey and now you guys have moved into even, you know, bigger deals, multifamily and other larger asset deals, kind of a natural evolution. What is kind of the, if you go back, you know, what are some of the things that you learned in the market in, let's just say 2012 to 2020, you know, maybe pre-COVID that have either helped or kind of shaped the way that you've been able to navigate really 2020 to 2024, which has been nothing short of every new thing you could imagine getting thrown at you is probably getting thrown at you. And yet the real estate market's been resilient. Sounds like Smartland's been resilient. How have you navigated that? And what did the past teach you maybe to better prepare you for where you are today?
Yeah, we could definitely go through that time cycle for sure. Put me in a time warp. What is that? Put me in a time machine real quick. So, wow, 2012, right? So 2012 was kind of this unknown time. Like, you know, you don't know if you're catching knives, right? Standing there catching knives, if the market's going to be really bottom out or where, if that was the bottom. And prices were so low on scattered site and that there's a lot of delta there to be able to still acquire in good secondary, tertiary neighborhoods, do the renovation, rehab, set them up as turnkeys. There's a nice, you know, one-to-one, one-to-two kind of 1.2 ratios on rents, kind of that classic metric that a lot of turnkey buyers are using. Some debt leverage kind of walked into the market at the time where turnkey buyers were able to start using a little bit of debt to buy investment property that was starting to materialize. That was probably going into like 14, 15. In 12, we probably saw some of the lowest prices that we've ever seen for single family residential. And so, and we'll get to 24 because as we got through 12 and we were buying a lot, we were managing a lot. We could see that the volume was really picking up. Steam was picking up. A lot of out of state, out of country investors were pursuing US real estate, which was kind of unusual to us. I mean, we kind of all came from different backgrounds. My partner Vadim and Irina, they came out of IT. Irina's our real estate broker here at Smartland. And so she holds the keys to the kingdom to the property management division for sure, as well as our acquisitions. And so there's a lot of heavy acquisition time. Prices were low. We were just at that time also growing our construction division more and more to accommodate kind of the incoming onslaught of these single family homes. And the more we looked at it, it just didn't seem like as though it was going to be as scalable at the speed that we would want it to harness the speed that we were looking for. And I know that, you know, if you look at even through the lens of like Zillow or Redfin that actually ended up kind of being, I guess, semi-successful or not so successful. I don't know. Everybody, I guess, has their own opinion on it with the iBuyer programs. But you know, volume and scale, even with money, you still need to have the capacity in the field to be able to meet those demands of not only cost of money, but managing the properties and then doing a good job. And so we always pursued quality over quantity. That was our number one thing that we stood on. That was definitely one of our key elements that we always grew with. And we always wanted to be investor centric because we're also, as I said, investors ourselves. And so we understand both sides of that table, you know, that it has to be fair. And so going through 2012, 13, 14, you know, kind of heavy buying, lots of single family, very low prices. Again, if you snapshot to today, those same homes are, you know, they've 3x, 4x, 5x in value in some cases. And so hindsight 2020, we wish we would have bought more. But also at that time, as I said before, we were still pioneers in the space. This was not a Wall Street, Main Street type of conversation. This was still, you are just a amateur because you're doing scattered site. So since you're not doing multifamily, you're an amateur, like you don't even know what you're talking about. You don't even qualify to be on our radar, right? So there was still this conversation throughout 12, 13, 14, 15, because build for rent was like 2015 was still like just at its infancy. I think the number is like, we don't do build for rent yet, but build for rent, if we were to do it, I mean, at that time in 15 even, you know, now we passed 13, 14, we're in 15, build for rent, I think was like 1% of the market or 0.3% of the market. Today, I think it's approached like over 8 or 9% of the market. So, I mean, you know, talk about like a time warp there, but that has, and we'll get to that in a second. So 2015, 16, I think at that point we started buying our first multifamily, and typically we try to do our test markets on ourselves. We were looking to scale at that point. We had buying power, we had track record, we had investors. We had all the right recipe for moving further into the marketplace and kind of spreading our wings and maybe scaling a little bit further. And so we began by purchasing at that time. I think it was the first purchase was a 21 unit. And the goal was to see, you know, what it would take to kind of go through the process, commercial lending, do it on our own at our risk. We tend to try to do things at our risk on our own first before we bring it to market. And we'll do a pilot. Maybe it won't be a giant pilot, but we'll definitely do a pilot of something before we try to bring it to our investors. Anyway, so that was 15, 16, pretty normal times. I would say they were pretty opulent in the sense of, you know, there was still plenty to buy. It wasn't as the market still was pretty calm, I would say. So it was even keel. And then kind of you walked into 17, 18, where folks started getting a little bit more reserved. 19, people were already talking about what does your downturn analysis look like, because interest rates. Market was getting overheated at that time, if I remember correctly. We had purchased a few more multifamily assets at the time. We were looking to acquire more, and we had just rolled out our first fund, I remember, at Smartland, a larger fund. So we had done a lot of various small asset funds to date, and then now we're approaching 2019, 2020, and the market was changing. We talked about, you know, Black Swan event, living through the great financial crisis, Black Swan events, COVID, so forth, so on, high interest rates, which we'll get to in a second. So we're in 2019, and we're starting to buy more larger multifamily assets at the time, at that, and at the same time in parallel, single family was beginning to slow down simply because the market was turning more to a flip rather than a rent, at least buy hold rent for us from a high velocity of capital turnover. We're looking at what is the best use of capital. And at that time, right, and market conditions will dictate that. And so we're agile enough where we can accommodate some of those market conditions and be able to pivot. We have a big enough team in place, not only internally, but also externally, to be able to accommodate a few pivots along the way. As I said, we were built out of this tough time. So we're all about being efficient and mobile. And so 19 and 20 and 19, as I said, I remember we were going into a multifamily deal, and the only conversation that actually at every single conference was, what does your downturn analysis look like? What does your downturn analysis? You know, everybody was screaming, the sky is falling. And then you had the Black Swan event, then you had COVID. And COVID really changed everything. People say it changed things. I mean, it really changed everything, right? It changed buyer perspective, and also at that time, buyer and seller kind of didn't align very well at that immediate moment. It was kind of unclear about where rents were going. So we had to make a strategic decision also to pause purchasing, because it wasn't clear who's going to pay the rent and how the rent's going to get paid. And we had just launched our fund, I remember, in 2019 at the time. And so we're all, you know, we had commitments from folks for the fund to go purchase. And here comes 2020, and things changed a little bit. So out of 2020, we kept full steam ahead. You know, looking back, hindsight 2020, should we have bought more? Sure, of course. No regrets. You know, you never have any regrets. You just have lessons. And so coming out of COVID, once things got a little bit more, when we had a little bit more foresight on kind of what was coming, the next storm came. So we purchased multifamily. We purchased right around maybe 1,000 doors or so, and a multitude of you know. So Jason, one thing that's really that I have to clarify is that we're really middle market. So we're not your typical mom and pop shop, and we're not your institutional shop. We're middle market, and so we're able to buy assets at great value because we're strategic about it, we're conservative. But also, when we're looking at commercial real estate and we're looking at these events and what's happening, you know, we're trying to put as much strategic thinking on it as possible. So I just mentioned that in 2019, we were approached at every single meeting. Every single conversation began with, what does your downturn analysis look like? 21, 22, people stopped asking these questions. And what we did believe in is that the multifamily market would be strong still. But what we were certain of is that free and cheap money can only be so long. And so when we were purchasing, over 95% of our portfolio is on a fixed position, very low interest position. And we were purchasing heavy value add that required a lot of renovation. So we were going into this war with an arsenal of money and a plan. So there were people going into this war, you know, 22 was probably the height of it when prices started peaking. And at that time, you know, lending was also kind of getting just kind of rolling. And so there's a lot of folks that are sitting on adjustables today that are feeling the pressure. So we're looking at market conditions very closely.
Well, you know, as you navigate through, you know, any investment cycle, and, you know, I think we're always in some form of cycle, right? Maybe it's good or it's bad or it's indifferent, but there's always some cycle. And I think you kind of highlighted that over the years, right? Each of those times that you referenced back to had challenges and opportunities, right? You know, the single family rental market had tons of properties, but the numbers stopped looking as good on, you know, rents because people were flipping. Like, you just kind of have to keep navigating. And so here we are today, you know, and these events, you know, with interest rates, I guess we'll get a little clarity here on maybe where they're headed. But I think the thing that people have to realize is no one has a clue, right? I mean, Wall Street bet on 6 raises in 2024, and we're almost halfway through and we don't have one yet. So, you know, it's starting to look, that's pretty darn unlikely. And I think people are guessing with the information available to them. And you used to be able to make longer term decisions. And today, I think, you know, it's hard to look too far out. So good for you guys for kind of approaching the market piece by piece by piece. And, you know, it's, I always love hearing real estate companies specifically or investors where, you know, their investment approaches shift and shifted throughout the years. Because I think anyone that's still doing the same way, buying real estate the same way they did today as they did 10 years ago, is probably leaving a lot of money on the table. You know, I'm all for getting good at what you do and tried and true and, you know, steady wins the race. But yeah, you've got to continue to grow. I want to talk about, you know, kind of where you're at today. You mentioned some of these assets that may have some pressure on them, right? Maybe a better word. And I don't know if you'll use it, but I'll use it, is that distressed, right? And we're hearing that a lot in the market. And what's going to happen? And so we're going to throw you on the hot seat for the quirky questions of the day. Our listeners won't let me get around that. And candidly, it's my favorite part, so I'm not going to get around it myself. But I will I will pick back up in just a second there. But until then, Amy's ready, locked and loaded. I'm going to go middle envelope today. Keep submitting your
questions
to allaboutalts@newviewtrust.com. Again, always my favorite part. I don't actually look inside these until the show itself. So this is just as much a mystery as it is to you. So, Steven, you ready?
All right, let's do it. I'm ready. Oh, man, I'm not a quirky off-the-cuff guy, but let's give it a go.
All right. Well, you better get comfortable being uncomfortable. You got 3 questions to get through. All right. Would you rather be able to fly or breathe underwater?
Fly. Definitely fly. That's an easy one for me. This way I can see the world's perspective. We began with bird's eye view. This is my life's calling. I need to see the world from a bird's eye view.
There you go. I'm with you on that one. I love the water. I think I'm part fish sometimes, but I don't know. There's way more to see from above than below. That's for sure. What's the most unconventional use of technology you've seen?
I don't know. I feel like all technology has a very conventional use. I mean, the burger flipping. Oh, you know what I saw? An unconventional use of technology was the robot for roofing.
The roofing robot. Tell me about that.
He could lay roofing shingles, like in a straight line, right? So they set the robot right on the roof. And I mean, I didn't see the whole process, but I mean, that was probably for me, that was probably pretty an unconventional use of tech, unexpected.
Interesting. Well, anytime I'm here in Florida, and anytime I see people on the roof working in the summertime, I think to myself, there's gotta be a better way to do this, right? So maybe that's it. The roofing robot. All right. Well, I know what I'm doing as soon as we get off this recording. Number 3, would you rather have the ability to control the time or read people's minds?
Control time for sure.
Yeah.
This is the thing. We could all sit and chat. We don't need to read each other's minds, but what we do need is to be able to have as much access to our time that we can.
I'm with you on that one. I'm not sure I'd want to read people's minds, candidly.
I don't know if I want to read people's minds either.
Yeah, you can't unhear some of that stuff, I suppose. So, Steven, you are off the hot seat. Thank you guys for submitting those questions. Keep them coming. We love getting through them and get good feedback on them. So keep them coming. All right. So we talked about, you know, kind of getting a little bit more clarity on kind of where you guys are today. We talked a little bit about this kind of assets under pressure or distressed assets. So let's maybe start with, you know, what what would you consider, and this is not necessarily have to be a textbook definition, but if we were to kind of say distressed assets or troubled assets or assets with pressure on them, just maybe give us your take or Smartland's kind of take on where are those boundaries? Like, what do they consider? What do they see opportunity today?
So I think we covered that there could always be opportunity in a variety of markets as market cycle. One of the things that we're just really tracking today are some of the parallels from like that great financial crisis, that 2008, 2011, 12 metric. What we saw, those conditions that we saw in residential, there being the same red flags are kind of resonating in commercial today. And it's not necessarily just multifamily, it's just commercial in general. So whether it's office, industrial, also multifamily, and it has a lot to do with just simply the, it's like a perfect storm, right? So it has to do everything with the high velocity interest rates. It has everything to do with peak pricing coming out of 22. It has everything to do with lending. It has everything to do with rents plateauing. So there's a lot of market conditions and segments, whether it's even storage or malls, that are kind of in this duress or tough time or distress. Yes, you're right. I was not really going to use the word distress today. You know, and somewhat it's a challenging word because it could be over applied or misapplied, because sometimes people think distress means like poor condition. But distress could also, and Jason, you're right. I mean, for using the term, so I'm not saying you're absolutely correct. I mean, distress could also venture into distress of your financial position. And earlier on in this conversation, we mentioned that our entire portfolio is like 95% at some sort of fixed debt. And so there's guys that are sitting at 95% adjustable debt that bought rate caps in 22 that were set to expire in 12 months or 24 months that were fairly cheap at the time. And with the intent that, you know, markets would soften up and rates would maybe come down. And actually, I think the Fed met about an hour ago. I haven't seen the report yet. I missed it. I was transitioning between a meeting and this event, meeting with Jason, with you today, and Newview. Speaking to the audience about this, is that so it's like a perfect storm. And so number one, outside of the rates going up, there's also a repricing. Assets are simply being repriced by banks. And so you have like both a condition where you're not able to refinance, possibly because you may not have a lender that's willing and able to look at your asset class. In a lot of cases, lenders in this, so let's just ratchet back a second. So a lot of this commercial lending market is held up by middle market banking. So it's not right. Like we know we've all been watching this unfold in the news, whether it was like Silver Bank or like recently NYCB and all these guys or Arbor Realty Trust, number one shorted trust or REIT currently. A lot of them issued adjustable debt with the idea that the operators were going to get the rents up, that the rents were going to continue to go up, and that, you know, that the interest rates would go back down or they wouldn't. Look, here's the, as you said earlier, also one of the things that's unpredictable, right? Like the velocity at which the interest rate went up. So then the idea that everybody understood that it would go up is probably true. The idea at the rate and velocity at which it went up, and that probably is what caught everybody more so footloose, right? It's not like the idea of it going up. Everybody understood that it's got to go up. It was how fast would it go up and how long would it stay there? And so the longer it stays there, the longer this pressure unfolds and mounts on some of these operators that may have not executed their business plan. We also talked about earlier that we were purchasing in 21 and 22, but we were purchasing with intent of heavy value add. So we're going in there with an arsenal of not only cash to deploy into modernizations, knowing that this was the goal, and right, we were buying a low enough basis where any type of movement would have been positive movement. And we were not projecting to those kind of overblown expectations that rents were going to continue to climb. If you look in today's environment, you know, rents are still strong. Like, it's way cheaper to be a renter than to be a buyer. And yesterday on the Today Show alone, I think it was like 37% cheaper to rent than to be a homeowner or something like that. So, I mean, there's a big gap, right? And so the expectation would be that, like, well, why aren't assets then still staying strong in a pricing metric? Well, you know, on a collective whole in a marketplace, we've replaced cap rates. That has moved. So that's repricing assets. Interest rates are up. That's repricing assets. And so even if you were just an operator and you're, again, hoping that things would continue being kind of status quo, you're in danger today, because a lot of middle market banks, just like sports teams, when they're talking about cap space for purchasing power, just like banks, they have cap space. They're driven by a certain amount of portfolio debt they can hold. And so if you have individuals that cannot refinance and get out of those portfolios, then they're not opening up cap space for new lending. And so if you have limited new lending against, you know, a lot of people, and we all see the headlines, it's in the trillions of dollars, right? And so folks are going to be in a tough spot. And so we're looking at that market as a giant opportunity. We have been in line for this opportunity, and we're getting in line for the opportunity. And we work together as a collective whole with our investors to be able to pounce on this opportunity, right? So look, it's like, it's definitely, as we've talked today, just thinking about that whole timeline trajectory of how things unfold. You know, if we look at Smartland a few years ago, there was a lot of single asset deal execution that we were doing. Today, we're just doing it under one holistic strategic fund. And partly because, as you said yourself, Jason, what's really important to understand is that real estate is really a long-term play. And kind of this, what arose out of the last decade, is that this idea that there are these short runs in real estate. And there are not short runs in real estate. If any known or well-known and regarded developer or real estate owner operator, if you look at their approach or their success, like March, you'll see it's over time. It wasn't over. Yes, of course, we all have wins along the way that are shorter term than expected. But you win real estate, yes, it is slow and steady. And slow and steady does win the race in real estate. It is over time. It's a wonderful tax. It can work in your benefit for tax savings. If you couple it with your IRA and you're using NewView and you're investing using your IRA and you're doing it as a strategy, you know, it should be on a 7 or 10 year strategy. It should not be on these to really maximize your tax deferment and wealth creation, especially via your IRA, you know, through NewView. Strategically, it should be more long term. That's really going to be probably the best output. Also, you want to work with somebody that's going to give you something more long term, in our perspective, because what we did witness was the spur of a lot of new operators come into the market over the last few years. And so you asked me, what is the distress? Well, the distress has to do with, you know, a lot of these operators, they didn't have an HQ, they didn't have a headquarters, they didn't have a real operation. They might have been a guy just on Instagram or, you know, promising you these outsized returns, 24, 28. I mean, we got to the point where at some point, you know, folks, I think that we're losing long sight or foresight of, you know, 28% returns have classically been, you know, high risk. And so folks were kind of getting intertwined into this new marketing era of what's out there and forgetting that, you know, real estate really should be considered on a long-term measure.
Yeah, I mean, you really nailed the approach in terms of how people need to think about it. And one of the things, the danger in any market that goes up like a hockey stick is that people think it lives forever, right? And, you know, look at the meme stock craze in 2020. And, you know, that stuff's really dangerous because people start thinking even Bitcoin, home prices in 2004 and five, right? I mean, it's all FOMO induced. And so you have to step back and say, you know, is there some fundamental driving this growth, or is it just a lot of people throwing a lot of fuel on a fire? Because at some point when the fuel stops, the fire stops. And I mean, people don't really talk about it because the market has done well, the public equity market, but there are so many stocks that have lost significant value over the last 3-4 years. I mean, significant value. And so I think as investors, you know, it's a little dangerous, and the real estate market has delivered really well. And you're right. You know, you got a lot of new issuers and a lot of new sponsors getting in to real estate investing, raising capital. And I'm all for it. I think it's a major positive, but I think track record is important. You know, it is important. If I'm going to put $50,000 into a deal, you know, I need to know how to get my money back out, and what does the exit look like, and do these individuals have you know, the knowledge in the marketplace, because you're going to stub your toe. Everybody has, everybody will. There's no doubt that you haven't. I certainly have, but it's,
sure have.
You know, it's, you hope that you learn the lesson and the experience and you do it with just a sore toe. It's when they get a little more painful. So yeah, I think we've got an interesting market ahead of us, right? You know, interest rates will tell a story, you know, client behavior or renter behavior will tell a story. How many units are coming into the market, depending on where you are? There's still a lot of development in cycle. And so that certainly tells part of the story. And so there's a lot of reasons why real estate could be distressed. And I do agree with your take, right? Distressed doesn't mean bad. It just means that it's got a lot of pressures that aren't helping the cause. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that play into that. But we talk to our clients. You know, you've brought up IRAs a couple of times. I mean, one thing we talk to our clients a lot about is in our education is, do you know what you're doing with your money? You know, and I'm buying an apartment complex. That's great. But do you know what you're actually doing, right? Are you going out and buying it? Is someone else buying it? How long are you going to hold it? What type of returns, like, you know, are you expecting? What's that downside, you know, risk that you have? Is there upside? What are the marketplace conditions like? If you're just throwing your money at something, whether it's a stock or a private real estate equity deal, like, that's never good. You can get lucky, but you need to be asking questions. So I think you kind of highlighted some of those things, but I can't encourage our listeners enough to ask questions. And if you're asking an issuer, you know, and if that's Steven and you pepper him with 20 questions and he's annoyed or he's not prepared to answer them, you probably have your answer, right?
Precisely, yep.
And so that's something that's really critical. And then just maybe the last thing that I'll kind of highlight that you mentioned, and I think this is a big one, especially right now, you know, is you got to understand what buy and hold means. You know, it's so different. And I think one of the things that I keep going back to kind of the meme craze is people were in and out of investments. They made 30% in a year, you know, and they were like, this is repeatable. And the reality is it's not even close to repeatable. Be grateful that it happened. And if it happens again in your lifetime, be grateful. But, you know, we look at a lot of investors that, you know, what are economic conditions going to look like in a year, 2-3 years? And I'm not saying they'll be better or worse or in between, but they'll be different than they look today. And they could be crazily better. They could be crazily worse, right? Nobody has a crystal ball. Precisely. So just be thinking through that, those types of things. I think it's something that we get attracted to the emotional side of investing, but we've got to understand what we're getting into. Let's maybe wrap up, you know, and I've loved kind of our discussion. I appreciate your take on real estate and kind of assets. Let's maybe, you know, a little bit more of a future facing question, Stephen. You know, looking at where you are today and certainly finding assets that have distress, completely understand that. Where do you think you'll be finding those assets? You know, is it geographics? Is it asset classes? Is it a combination of both? Not necessarily looking for the secret sauce that you're going to use for the next 12 to 18 months, but just, you know, where are you guys looking? What are you looking for? We understand how things get distressed, but yeah, maybe put a little meat on that bone and give us a little more insight if you don't mind.
Yeah, thanks. So, we're targeting with our strategy, we are targeting high growth markets that saw a lot of development, that saw a lot of that kind of real rampant movement. So it is going to be Miami, Ohio, Arizona, and Florida are our key geographic markets. Typically, we're looking for assets that are somewhere between 40 or call it even 20 to 150 units, maybe maximum 180, 200 units. But as said, our strategy really has been to play right above that mom and pop line and right below that institutional line. And it has a lot to do with having cash capacity to execute with. And so we're already seeing today 2020 prices on certain assets that are in this distressed condition. And you actually said it perfectly, is that it's not necessarily, a bad condition or financial. It could be just something that's uncomfortable for that particular deal. And so our strategy is quite simple. We leverage our cash position to execute on deals where we just strategically can execute quicker using the power of cash and our network of off-market deal sourcing. So part of the and also you actually really mentioned as well, is that, you know, maybe somebody's thinking about buying an asset, and it's not about somebody not having the wherewithal financially to buy one, but having the right access to the right ones, right? So if you're buying an asset that maybe we have passed on, there may have been a good reason, right? So our collective power, us being your professional real estate investment arm or something like us, is critical to any professional that is accredited or high net worth or just is looking for passive income. Because you could turn your hobby really quickly into a job if you don't know what you're doing. And so unless you're looking for two jobs, you know, this is the area that we service, right? So a lot of folks, they've earned their ability to invest in real estate in a certain way or a certain means or in a certain strategy or profession. And so we do this every day professionally, just like however you did your job to make that money, to be able to go and invest and talk to Smartland or go through New View and execute your IRA, you know, investment into an alternative. And so I think that's really important to identify, because we have this conversation day in, day out with folks that and a lot of times we're having conversations with hobbyists that have become employed by their own real estate, you know. So like they've bought now 20, 30 units, and it was really exciting, and now they've learned that it's a really big full-time job, and so they want the passive benefits, right? And so what we're looking at is our strategy again is Miami, Ohio, Arizona, and Florida. And we saw high growth in all of those places. We saw a lot of development. And so a lot of the data that we pull, our analysts that they're sifting through, right? So Jason, you have to also look at it like from the perspective of that we have this buy box that we operate in, and we have people hunting every day for deals, right? So like it's not like Steven or Vadim and Irina walking around thinking about where's our next deal. There's physical people sitting and exploring and hunting for a strategic purchase and for a strategic purpose, because as we mentioned, all of these events that have led up to it over this timeline, whether starting at 2012 and moving fast forwarding 2024, you know, people are under new pressures, and those pressures are leading them into sales. And so as we mentioned, it's not about individuals not having the ability to buy or having the wherewithal, because our clients every day, they show us with a check but they have the ability to go and buy one, right? But not necessarily have access to the best ones or insight to the best opportunity. And that has to do with track record and executability, right? So, and that leads back to track record, because brokers sell to people that can close, because brokers eat off commissions. Commercial lenders want to lend to people that can close because they eat off commissions. And so this vast network of folks that develops leads us into this ability to buy. You couple it with our data and our strategy, we have knowledge base already internally on where folks are in trouble, right? So they may have been a small developer out of Miami that was putting up a 20 unit boutique. You know, they started in 22. They got a construction loan in 22. They went through a rigorous amount of shortage on labor, increased labor costs, increase on material costs. Rents did not continue to go up, and now their note is due. They're coming out of their construction bridge loan, and they need an exit, and they don't have anybody that can, you know, that's going to refinance them. They may only be doing a boutique. Maybe they do only one or two. And so this developer is in trouble. And so this is the type of deal strategy that we're looking for. And also for guys that were buying with value add intent and just simply didn't get to the, are not getting to the finish line. And so that's the strategy. And, you know, this is what the market has birthed, and the power of working together, putting our money alongside with our investors. This is what gives all of us that upper hand. And to be able to go buy institutional grade product.
Well, every market creates opportunity, and you know there's good buying opportunities, and there's unfortunately for some buying opportunities that didn't materialize. And if you can step in and help get those over the finish line and do it while relieving the stress of the current operator and doing it in a way that helps you and your investors make money, then it's a win-win. You got to be doing what, right? Is it Warren Buffett, buy when others are selling, or buy when there's blood in the streets. So, nobody's cheering for things to go bad. But anytime the market starts flashing some signs of distress, it starts opening up new doors to opportunities. So, well, Stephen, I appreciate you walking us through kind of your timeline and history. Congratulations. I mean, being in any marketplace or business for 12 years is a lot of time. Not everybody makes it that far, but being able to do that through different market cycles and continuing to navigate says a lot about you and your team there. So, good luck as we see what interest rates do, and good luck on this new capital raise that you guys have, and hope everything goes well. But thank you most importantly for sharing your knowledge and wisdom to our listeners today. Appreciate you having you.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jason. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and we'll continue as we bring season two to a close. We've had a great run of speakers, and couldn't be happier with the group that we've had so far. We've got a few more before we close the season out, so continue to stay tuned. Hit the like, share, subscribe button. As always, help us grow the community of alternative asset investors, not just investing in alternatives, but finding tax-efficient ways to keep more of what they make. And we'll be here, and hopefully we'll see you guys next week on the All About Alts podcast. Take care.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope the information within this podcast has given you the tools that you need to find your way to financial independence. We would love to partner with you on this journey. Text ALTS, that's ALTS, to 407-708-1853 to learn more about how to get started today. Don't forget to follow us to make sure you don't miss a second of content, and we'll see you next week.